Good morning. This is WGXC 90.7 FM Acra. You are listening to Now Boarding with Jim and Dan. We are joined this morning with a guest, Peter Young. Peter, hello.
Good morning.
So, Peter, you are originally from the Midwest, and you found your way here at some point in time?
Yeah, back in the early 80s, I was living in the Twin Cities, and Jay Unger, fiddle player from out here that a lot of people probably are aware of, he did some of the work on Ken Burns' TV special in the Civil War, played the background theme. He came through town to play Garrison Keillor's show, and I met Jay, and we hit it off, and he gave me an opportunity to come out here and play music. So in the middle of winter 1980, I packed it up, came to the East Coast, having never been here before. It was an amazing deal. U-Haul had a problem. Too many of their trucks were migrating westward. And so they were offering a free truck to anyone who was willing to pack it up and head east. And so I came out here and discovered the Hudson Valley and was surprised in almost every way. The Hudson Valley is a very different place than what Midwesterners imagine it to be.
Okay. And I mean, what was your first eye-opening perspective? What was so different when you first came around?
I think the sight of the Catskills. I first came to the Hudson Valley and lived down in Dutchess County in a little hamlet called Pequaig.
Okay.
Sounds like something out of a Herman Melville novel. Mm-hmm. Seeing the Catskills and seeing that there were mountains and a lot of wild country is what surprised me. I think it's fair to say that most Midwesterners, if they haven't been east, tend to think that it's a giant industrial zone.
Okay.
Covered with parking lots and too many commuters and pollution and general insanity.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a perception in the Midwest that we have the Catskills, we have the Adirondack State Park, the largest park in the country, that there's mountain lions and bear and creatures running around. And that was an eye-opener for me and a very pleasant surprise.
Uh-huh. And what about in terms of the Hudson River Valley itself with the not so much, you know, the different landscape that you found, but the point, the history that it was Dutch? Was there any sort of education about that, or
I became aware of the fact that, you know, the Dutch, the English, and the French were all here in that one point in time, all sort of fighting with each other, and they would gain the allegiance of the Native Americans for a little while.
Okay.
And there was, and of course there were the great families along the particularly on the east bank of the Hudson River, the Livingstons, the Roosevelts, the Van Rensselaers, those people. And we never had that sort of aristocracy in Minnesota. It was a much more sort of egalitarian culture.
Well, that's very interesting. And Jimmy, if you'd just like to say hello to our audience, you're permitted to do so.
Thank you, Dan, for finally allowing me to say hello. Hello, everyone. It's good to be here again. And Peter, thank you for being on the show today. This is very interesting. You know, please continue on, Dan. This is great. This is great. You know, another guest on. And Peter, thank you for being with us today.
All right, great.
Hello to Singapore.
Peter has a lot of, he knows a lot of Singapore, Jimmy, but perhaps that'll be another place in time. Right now, we're going to talk about your home territory of the Hudson, of Hudson itself and Hudson Valley. Okay, so just chime in for no more than a 5-second stint for the next 20 minutes. If you go over that, we'll have a, we'll do something when you return.
Regulations, I tell you.
All right.
You know, one of the things I noticed coming here 33 years ago, 1980, was the fact that almost every community in the Hudson Valley is situated at a junction of a creek and the Hudson River. I presume it was all about power, water power. And it's amazing how these communities are situated. When I came here, most of the towns in the Hudson Valley, Poughkeepsie, Newburgh, Beacon, Hudson, were in pretty tough shape. And I couldn't believe it, because they all looked to me to be ideally situated, great architecture. they had a history of commerce. They had a they were an important part of America's political history. There was a sort of rich fabric here that sort of deteriorated, I guess, when Jobs started going off to the third world.
Right.
And I was puzzled and confused as to how this happened, because from my perspective as a Midwesterner, the Hudson Valley is endowed with just fantastic resources.
Yeah.
And, of course, now we're seeing it all come back, which mm-hmm. is wonderful.
And to see that potential, and knowing somewhat about you, Peter, and your passion of revitalizing and trying to push for something that, you know, maintains the preservation of the natural setting and the beauty that surrounds us, that must have been, you must have had plans already to try to restore or have some sort of, you know, some sort of dream to find a place and, you know, create or recreate the richness that was in that state of deterioration. Can you explain?
There was the one special moment for me. I worked with a fellow named George Vengren in the tree maintenance business for a while. Back mm-hmm. in the early 80s, I was playing music and then helping him as a tree specialist. And we had the contract to do all the wonderful old estates along the east bank of the river. And those who are old enough might remember the storm of 87. Mm-hmm. I believe it was October 4th. Okay. A huge amount of wet, heavy snow hit the Hudson Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was the snow built up on the branches because the leaves were still on the trees.
Mm-hmm.
They broke branches, and you woke up the next morning to a Hudson Valley that was devastated. And it took the cleanup crews and the power line guys months and months to clean it up. But at that time, my friend George, who ran this little tree service company, got the contract to clean up Olana.
Oh.
And so there we were in mid-October up at Olana, in this glorious location, and I think that's the moment at which the Hudson Valley got into my blood.
Uh-huh.
I was eating my peanut butter sandwiches up there on the hill looking over at the Catskills.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, let me tell you, I've done that quite a bit, cleaning up limbs and taking down trees just out in the winter off-season. And yeah, I mean, Olana. Jim, have you ever been to Olana yourself?
Yeah, of course I've been to Olana.
Okay. All right, perfect. We'll cue you in 5 minutes later. Yeah.
One of the things that happened to me is that I discovered the Hudson River School of Painting.
Which the Olana Estate was.
Olana Estate was the home of Frederick Church.
Uh-huh.
There were, loosely speaking, maybe 100, 150 artists. And school is being used just as a catch-all term. There mm-hmm. wasn't actually an academy. But I was fascinated with those beautiful, luminous pictures.
Oh, yeah.
And that style of painting was popular here from about 1830 till about 1880.
Uh-huh.
It sort of flourished for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one of the great ones right here in Hudson, Sanford Robinson Gifford.
Okay.
His father ran an ironworks here. His father's name was Elihu Gifford.
Uh-huh.
And walking with a friend one day about 6 or 7 years ago, I came upon the whole Gifford family plot up in our cemetery.
Oh.
Completely neglected, run down, stones tipped over.
Just by serendipity.
Just
you came
walked
upon
up to all these Giffords, and I thought, gee, maybe Sanford Robinson Gifford is right here. And sure enough, there he was.
Oh, wow.
Right next to his wife, Mary. He was born 1823, died 1880. And I stood there with goosebumps for 20 minutes because Gifford is a big deal.
Yeah.
A real major Gifford could be a $2 or $3 million painting.
Really?
These days. Yeah.
Wow.
So if you got one in your attic, give me a holler.
Okay. Yeah.
But I was able to find a wonderful young stonemason and fiddle player by the name of Aldo Lavaggi. Aldo
uh-huh.
Aldo grew up in the Woodstock area and had a lot of experience moving bluestone around. So Aldo spent about 6 months up there straightening out that grave site, all 22 Gifford graves. He pulled the bases out. The bases were extremely heavy. They were white marble,
uh-huh.
and they needed to be reset. We laid down new gravel in the trenches so that it would drain properly.
Hmm.
And if anyone's interested, you can just go online and do a Google search for Gifford's grave, and you'll see the little website we put up.
Okay.
And it turned out beautifully. I had some very generous patrons come forward and chip in to help support the project financially.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gifford's grave is up in the northwest corner of the cemetery. It's the area closest to the hospital, near that strange intersection, that sort of five-way confusing and dangerous intersection.
Yeah, we were there this week, Peter, and we were doing business there. And we closed down one of those lanes, actually, so it was even more, there was even more commotion.
What I'm hoping is that the Gifford Project will sort of inspire further interest and further restoration of our cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a tricky business. I don't want to see it perfect, because one of the things about that cemetery, it's got a sort of disheveled, funky charm about it that's really wonderful. And mm-hmm. I don't want to see it turn into a military cemetery where everything's lined up, you know, perfectly.
Yeah.
But I think we could certainly put some little work parties together just on an informal basis. And I think you volunteered that you have a chainsaw.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, you know, what I'd like to do is just get a few people together on an occasional basis, go up there, and tidy it up a bit. And our DPW chief, the Department of Public Works, is a mm-hmm. fellow named Rob Perry, and he's always been extremely supportive of any effort to help out in the cemetery.
Okay, great. That's that sounds like a great project. And, yeah, I would love to do that. I love using the chainsaw. Maybe when Jimmy returns, he can help us as well. Now, Peter.
Dan, I'm going to take 5 seconds to say I stay far away from chainsaws, but continue.
And you stay far away from work. Anyway, now this period of that you speak about, 1830 to 1880,
yep.
The Hudson River School, that was, the whole movement, this was world-renowned, movement?
It was. These painters were really good. Most of them had the opportunity to study in Europe, so they mm-hmm. went to places like Paris, Madrid, Dusseldorf in Germany,
uh-huh.
Rome, and they got really good academic training. In fact, our man Gifford, he was there and spent quite a bit of time, particularly in Italy,
mm-hmm.
and painted just spectacular pictures. So these were not hillbilly artists. These,
right.
these guys had really fine academic training. And when they came home, I think the landscape was so inspiring for them. And mm-hmm. I think they had a sense of the divine mm-hmm. in the landscape.
Uh-huh.
And so when you see those glorious, luminous pictures that they painted,
yeah,
it's not just a pretty picture. It's something else. It's mm-hmm. a statement about, you know, the new America, which much of which was not all that well explored yet.
Mm-hmm.
And those pictures are an important part of our cultural history. But for some reason, we kind of lost sight of them in the 50s and 60s and so forth, and they fell out of favor.
Yeah,
I guess we were focused on Wonder Bread and Formica or something. going to the moon, and America kind of lost sight of the value of these amazing pictures. But about 1980, in the early to mid-80s, a few New York City dealers figured it out. They sort of rekindled interest.
Okay.
One in particular, a guy named Alex Acevedo, mm-hmm. was instrumental in sort of raising the awareness and reviving interest in these magnificent mm-hmm. paintings. I hate to think how many of them were thrown into dumpsters.
Yeah.
But there's still a few around, and every once in a while, a fresh one still pops up. I've been here 23 years now, and I keep waiting for the little old lady to come walking in the shop with one.
Yeah, right.
It hasn't happened, and it took me a long time to figure out why. And the answer is that those artists never sold their important finished works up here in Columbia County.
Where?
They might have done sketches up here, but the patrons, the people who were buying them, were in New York City,
okay.
in Hartford, in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
They were painted for wealthy collectors in metropolitan areas.
Okay.
So the attics and basements of Hudson aren't teeming with a supply of these great pictures.
So many of these artists involved in the Hudson River School, they were making a profit while they were working, as opposed to many artists who posthumously they might become more renowned and
Gifford,
their value.
Gifford and Church and Cole. Thomas Cole was across the river in Catskill. Gifford was here. Frederick Church, of course, was up at Olana.
And Church had money. I mean,
Church had a lot of money. His father, I think, was in the insurance business in Hartford, so
okay.
he was a playboy painter from the beginning. But I think he had a major picture. It's now at the Met in New York City.
Uh-huh.
It's called Heart of the Andes, and it's a huge picture. It's about 8 feet across. It's painted down in Ecuador.
Yeah.
I think he got $25,000 for that in 1854,
wow.
which was a fortune.
Yeah, yeah.
Gifford got $2,500 here and there. And at that time, if you do the conversion, that translates into serious money today. So
yeah.
they were they were appreciated in their day, and there was a building down there called the 10th Street Studio, where they collectively painted. A lot of the great Hudson River painters had a studio in that building, and what they would do is go afield, do pencil sketches, or maybe little oil sketches, but the finished picture would be painted down there at the 10th Street Studio.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the era that we're speaking about, mid-19th century, that time, not only was it a cultural occurrence with the Hudson River School, but the whole river valley was somewhat of a Silicon Valley back then. I mean, it was a massive transit highway from the Great Lakes after the canal came across the central part of the state, and I mean, it was booming with all the mill towns and, you know, continuing down. Do you have...
One of the things about that period is that there was a lot of commerce, a lot of industry, as you say. There were a whole lot more... There are a lot more trees now than there were then.
Okay.
You look back at some of the old landscapes from the time and you say, geez, where's all the trees?
Yeah.
You know, in New England, used to be 20% forest and 80% open. That has now completely reversed itself. It's 80% forest and 20% open.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, there were sheep everywhere and crops and so forth. And then at some point, I think people figured out that the soil out in Ohio and Indiana and Minnesota was easier to work with.
Yeah.
They headed west.
Uh-huh. Jeez, that's great. And what about today, Peter? What's you're talking about the cemetery project. I know that you were involved quite influentially in preventing the development of the St. Lawrence Cement Company. Mm-hmm. Would you like to say anything about that? It's been, what, 6-7 years since then?
Yeah, that was a tough one.
And I think perhaps if there's spirits of the Hudson River School painters still about, they would probably recognize you as one of the prominent preservationists.
They might have mixed emotions. I mean, certainly there's sympathy for industry. I mean, we have to recognize that industry provided jobs, and I appreciate that. And when I got involved in that issue, I had a little bit of a hard time dealing with the issue that there's a lot of folks who need to raise a family and pay the bills and have a job. And I was not trying to, in any way, you know, make life miserable for them. But the company that was trying to site this massive plant here had a horrendous track record. At the time I got on the internet, I had a friend with access to LexisNexis, which is basically a search engine that gets you into newspaper headlines. It's kind of a legal database.
Mm-hmm.
I did the homework on the company, and once I saw what their behavior had been like in other locations, I said, no way. I mean, they were in trouble in just about every community that they tried to operate in. Massive amounts of litigation, paying huge fines and penalties, price fixing. I mean, it's a predatory, abusive European corporation that basically wanted to use us as the third world. And so even though I did appreciate that there were folks here who had a tradition of working in the cement plant, and a lot of kids grew up in Hudson, their dad worked there, and I understand that. But that particular company, I felt, was a bad fit for Hudson if we're trying to revive ourselves.
Yeah.
If we're trying to build an economy that appreciates the old architecture and the quality of life that we have here, that was going to be a big problem. And and so that's what got me involved. But in any case, things are moving ahead in a good direction now. You see a lot of new energy in town. I think the thing that I notice most recently is we're starting to see larger structures being rehabilitated. In the beginning, when Hudson started to perk up, it was pretty much small buildings, kind of mom-and-pop structures like the one that you or I live in. We're now starting to see people take on projects like an old school or an industrial building or something that takes some more financial horsepower to pull it off.
Yeah, I see that myself. And a lot of businesses could go into many of those larger buildings, and yeah, they could do just well.
It's my favorite thing about living in Hudson is watching this happen. And I've always wanted, and I don't know how one would do this, but maybe the economics department at Marist College or something could undertake the project to determine how many craftspeople are at work in this city and in this county on a regular basis. Plumbers, electricians, carpenters, surveyors, landscapers, painters. It's an amazing number of independent contractors working for really good wages.
Yeah.
And I'd love to figure that number out. And because I think if we could appreciate the economic impact of all that, it would be a pretty surprising number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, you know, that's not studied at all, really.
Yeah. There must be some way to aggregate those numbers. But those folks are not working for starvation wages. They're being paid extremely well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's so much activity in the area of particular restoration craftsmanship that I think it's a big driver of our economy, and it may be the biggest one, but yeah. I don't have the numbers.
Yeah, very small business owners, you know, there's still opportunity out there.
Yeah,
and I think with, you know, the correct ambition and talent, they can seize it. Now, I know you only have a couple more
moments. I can hang
moments.
On for a bit, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What would you... what would you suggest to the visitor that hasn't been to the Northeast, hasn't been to the Hudson River Valley? What spots would you recommend? And, you know, besides your studio, what
yeah.
would you
come and drop a few dollars yeah. at my place? Well, I mean, there's the obvious places like Olana. You know, mm-hmm. that's such a spectacular place and gives you such a big overview of the Hudson mm-hmm. Valley that you got to go there. Mohunk would be another great one.
For anyone
doesn't know it's down in Ulster County. It's up on the Shawangunk Ridge.
Okay.
It's a magnificent old hotel started by a Quaker family named Smiley. And it's on 12,000 acres, and most of that is accessible to the general public for hiking.
Okay.
And it's up there on that beautiful limestone ridge. It's an old 19th century hotel that's been added onto about five times.
Uh-huh.
And it's not a glitzy Catskills resort. This is a rustic place. It feels more like an Adirondack lodge.
Uh-huh.
Certainly the site of the old Catskill Mountain House, mm-hmm. that is directly across the river from us up on the ridge there on what is called the Escarpment Trail.
Right.
And that was a magnificent hotel built in 1826.
Mm-hmm.
And in its day, it was the most widely popular hotel in the world.
Amazing.
Ulysses Grant was up there, mm-hmm. Queen Elizabeth, Mark Twain.
Hmm.
And then in the 1960s, it had deteriorated to the point where it was taken down. I think the state burned it. It must have been a spectacular fire to watch from this side.
Jeez.
But the good news is that in the process of cleaning that up, the state acquired a huge amount of acreage up there, so most all of that is a place where you can run and hike and camp. You've probably been up there a few times.
Yeah, I was in Catskills earlier this fall, but I haven't been on the escarpment. I haven't checked this out.
You can drive. You go up to Haines Falls,
right.
A little village up there,
exactly,
and then you go north a couple miles on a county road, and there's a access there. And to get
is
up
it
there,
County 25. Take the right at Stewart's?
Yes.
That's a beautiful road.
Yeah, it's a beautiful road. And there's the DEC mains a parking lot there, and there's a large campground. There's two lakes called North and South Lake. And you can walk literally to the site of where the Catskill Mountain hung out over the escarpment.
Uh-huh.
And there's a plaque there that commemorates it. And then from there, there's all kinds of trails. You can hike for days along that area.
Hmm.
So that I'd recommend. You know, a quiet little place that not a lot of people take advantage of is Bashbish Falls.
Yeah.
Over near Copaic mm-hmm. on Route 22, right up against the Massachusetts border. I love that place. And I on a Thanksgiving or a Christmas afternoon, it's a nice little hike. You can go in there and walk to the falls. It's not spectacular, but it's a sweet little place. And I would imagine it was a special place in Native American culture. It must have been, you know.
Yeah, those are great falls there. I've been there, you know, probably about a dozen times growing up as a kid. The water's frigid in the summertime. It's nice.
And there's also High Falls over near Philmont.
Yeah.
And that recently became accessible. The Columbia Land Conservancy acquired some of that property. And you can go in there, I think it's off Roxbury Road, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And there's a parking lot there, and you walk in perhaps about three-quarters of a mile, and that's a pretty spectacular falls. It's
mm-hmm.
probably a couple hundred feet high, and if you happen to catch it when the water's high, it's a raging torrent coming over that cliff.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was there just a couple days ago.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of a sleeper that I love.
Yeah, it's Philmont itself, I think Philmont has a lot of potential. being refurbished, such as Hudson has been.
Yeah.
It was in its day, mid-19th century, up until, you know, I would say the mid part of this century, 20th. It was quite the it was quite the town.
Yeah.
It had a lot going in terms of employment, in terms of businesses, in terms of bars, and, you know, when the train tracks ran through there, it was quite lively.
Yeah, yeah, and water power everywhere. I don't know when water power began to fade. I suspect when steam came into being.
Mm-hmm.
But between about 1800 and 1850, water power was driving the Hudson Valley.
Yeah, yeah. As you say, all these mill towns. Jimmy, do you have any place that we have failed to recognize, acknowledge?
Peter has done a great job, and actually, you may not believe this, but even myself grew up climbing Bashbush. So, good call on including that, Peter. Good job.
All right. Well, WGXC now boarding viewers. Peter has made the sign that he is all finished. Peter, thank you very much. That was very insightful, and we appreciate it. Perhaps in the future you'll be on again when, yeah.
Thanks so much, and nice to be with you, Jimmy. Hope to meet you here in the 518 area code someday.
Yes, yes, yes. We don't do area codes anymore, Peter. It's country codes, the plus one. I hope to be there soon. And, Peter, thank you very much for coming on the show today.
All right. Peter's waving goodbye, and he had a very good laugh about your country coach, Jim. Always the entertainer, Jimmy. And that was very refreshing to have Peter on. Usually you're just hearing continuous banter amongst Jimmy and myself, but we have been educated. That was I learned some information about the Mohonk down in Ulster County and the escarpment, the old hotel that was so much in demand back in the mid-19th century. And yeah, the project that's Peter wants to lead in our cemetery. So Jim, I know you have a fascination of the morbid, of the occult, of the just spirits and Halloween and all that activity altogether. Maybe you could, you know, provide hot chocolate or something when you return here for everyone who's working there.
I am a little bit towards the morbid, and my favorite holiday is by far Halloween. But it's great. I definitely will have to meet Peter when I am back in the States at some point.
Yeah. Now, Jim, what is happening in Singapore? I know that you went to a traditional Indonesian wedding just a week ago or so. Tell us about that. I know that this is going to be interesting. Go ahead.
Yes, I did go to an Indonesian, traditional Indonesian wedding. I have to say, wow, you know, something very impressive. But before I get into my my normal banter, I have to just, on a serious note, you know, Dan, you and I have been on many trips, and I don't know if you're aware of this, I'm guessing you probably are, but, you know, many of our trips start by taking the Metro North train from Poughkeepsie right on down to Grand Central, and, you know, I did hear today that one of the trains did derail in the Bronx, and from what I understand, there is 4 deceased and over 60 injured. And I just want to say, you know, my thoughts and prayers, our thoughts and prayers, go out to the family of the victims and the injured, and hopefully they can get to the bottom of that. And yeah, it's a very, very tragic story.
Yes, you're right, Jim. I saw that right before I came out today to the studio. And yeah, we've quite a number of times have been on the Metro North, and yes, our thoughts and prayers to those deceased, those family members. You know, a lot of times if you want to get a Amtrak here, and yeah, it's you know, you think that flight is sometimes the only transit that has accidents, but trains derail. I know after I returned from the northern strip of Spain back in the winter, early spring, not too long after that, when the high-speed trains there, it had a derailment. I think it was quite extensive, the toll there. But four dead, that's, you know, four too many for here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's when you're on the train, you know, you don't even really think about train derailing or anything of that nature. But, you know, it's definitely tragic for all of us in New York, New York City to upstate. It's a big means of travel for us. And, you know, I feel bad, and, you know, definitely our thoughts and prayers are with the families of the victims and family and friends. And, you know, hopefully we can get to the bottom of what happened, and it won't happen again.
Yeah, exactly. That's all that can be done. That's all that can be done, Jim. I'm sure we'll learn more information as everything goes on. So, back to your vicinity, Jim. Tell me about this wedding. I'm sure you probably took in some good drink and some good food. What else happened?
Yeah, so traditional Indonesian wedding. So I went to the wedding, and actually two of our friends here in Singapore, both are from Indonesia, one from Jakarta and one from Semarang. And the wedding was being held in Semarang. The groom's father is a business owner there, and he basically they wanted the wedding to be in Semarang. So we went there, actually flew last Saturday from here to Semarang, which Semarang is on the Java Island of Indonesia, in between basically Jakarta and Surabaya. So we land there, you know, it was basically what I expected. I've been to Batam. Batam is very close to Singapore, just a ferry ride away. But it was very similar. The food was much better. And, you know, we got there. We went to our hotel, checked in. And right after we checked in, it's basically onto the pre-wedding dinner. So basically, in the U.S., now, I have to mention that both of the people getting married, they also were of Catholic religion. So very similar to the U.S. Indonesia is a primarily a Muslim country, but this couple was Catholic. So we did a normal Catholic wedding, but it was much different beyond that.
Okay.
Dan, let me throw it back to you. Have any, why don't you give us, you've been to more weddings than me. Why don't you go very quick, you know, why don't you tell me one of the more extravagant weddings that you've been to?
My cousin down in Long Island, at one of the, country clubs where one of the PGA U.S. Opens, U.S. Championships was held. It was held at that country club. And that was in a, you know, traditional five-hour-long reception. And it was in a very expensive restaurant area. And all the appetizers were just pure high-end cuisine, and all throughout the evening, all sorts of, you know, the main course was great beef or fish or what it usually is, and then, yeah, elaborate food and, you know, open bar for the duration, any drink that you would want, and, yeah, that was one of the more elaborate. I think they had they had a live band there, which was pretty more expensive than a DJ, but yeah, 5 hours, you know, pure comfort, any sort of cuisine that you would like, really, or, you know, any sort of the whole range of the taste buds. Yeah, that's I don't know, Jim, I'm not in the wedding business, I'm not a wedding planner, but go ahead. Yeah, I think most people have been to a wedding that, you know, is traditional American. Like that?
Yeah, now, how many people were at that wedding?
Probably about 300.
300. So basically, what you just described to me was the night before the wedding, the dinner.
Okay.
Prior to the actual wedding. That is basically what happened the night before the dinner. So when we get in, we check into the airport, and it's right to this dinner, which basically have 300 people, entertainment, buffet. Everyone sat at round tables, and they had actually just seats for the groom's father's employees, so they weren't sat at a table, they were just kind of lined in seats. And they had multiple, I mean, food, Western food, Indonesian food, Singaporean food from all over, Indian food. I mean, everything was covered as for the food. And it was basically like a normal reception in the U.S. is what basically happened the night before the wedding.
Uh-huh.
So I go there, Dan. I'm like, wow. You know, it's not at all what I expected. I've been the best man in a wedding, and I was at a dinner the night prior, and it was a pretty extravagant wedding. But at that dinner, there was maybe 40, 50 people. It was at a nice little restaurant, very kind of quiet, you know, everyone just talking, a speech here, a speech there. But this one, I mean, it was like a reception. I mean, they had the Congo line going and everything. The only difference is there was really no alcohol.
Okay.
Being in Indonesia, and, you know, it's really, alcohol's not a big thing at weddings here.
Uh-huh.
Now, most of the people there, as far as I'm aware, were not Muslim, which Muslim would infer that you're probably not going to drink, or, you know, there's no need to have alcohol present. These people were not Muslim, but there was no alcohol there.
You must have been highly disappointed.
Being the guy that he is, you know, he grew up fairly most of his life in Singapore, and his Singapore friends and myself, he did make sure to bring some Johnny Walker for us. So, you know, I can't say it was an alcohol-free night, because it definitely was not, but there really was no alcohol served. You know, it's basically whatever, actually the groom brought for his friends. Is what the alcohol was. But
okay.
Other than that, everything was the same as a normal reception.
Oh.
So that goes from, I think it was 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. the night prior to the wedding.
Uh-huh.
And after that, you know, we go to sleep, go back to the hotel, go to sleep. We wake up the next day, 8 a.m., and we get on the bus. There was two buses bringing us all from the hotel to the actual ceremony in the church. The church ceremony was held at 11 a.m. on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
So the 11 a.m. Sunday church ceremony, that was very, very much like weddings I've been to in the U.S., very similar. There was no flower girl or thing like that, but everything else was very similar. You know, they had the groomsmen and the bridesmaids and all of that. It was a little different. There were slight differences, but nothing major. I mean, they had the candle that was lit, and, you know, things I've seen at weddings in the U.S. I don't think there was anything major. On a quick side note, I was able to walk into the church and put my hand in the holy water, and this time it didn't burn. Can you believe it?
Amazing. You must have had some sort of special ointment.
Now, Dan, I will say it didn't burn, but the water did start to bubble and steam. But we'll just leave that, let that be. I don't know, maybe I'm progressing. I don't know, but let's just say, but hey, you know, it didn't burn my fingers this time when I put the hands in there. And it was actually the first time I received communion in another country. I think, another country, even another state. You know, maybe I don't want to get in the religious road. That's not me. But just a quick side note to the whole thing.
And probably in a decade.
After the wedding, you know, we went back to the hotel. Everyone got back on the bus a couple hours later. The whole ceremony was probably about an hour and a half. And it was very typical wedding ceremony in the church. So we go back, we get on the bus, we go back to the hotel. We basically have 3 hours of just kind of downtime. And then 5 o'clock, we're all boarding the buses to go to the reception. And this reception, I mean, was, I don't even know, I mean, talk about extravagant. It was like, I felt like I was going to the VMAs at this thing. I mean, there was a camera crew. There were hosts of the event.
Really?
I mean, it was just something. Dan, I have a video. I'm going to put it up on either my website or Facebook sometime soon.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, literally, Dan, I mean, there were boom-operated cameras. I mean, the whole works. There were two hosts. And it was pretty about 1,200 people.
Really?
It was just wild. They gave away, and there was also they gave away gifts at these things, and they gave away cellular phones. They gave away LCD TVs, and
what?
The grand prize was a motorcycle.
Really?
So that's just Dan. Yes. They it was very, very extravagant.
This must have been.
It was the whole venue itself. I mean, it could hold 1,200 people. There were flowers all. You walk on like white rose petals, you walk over just to get to your seat. And I mean, then you get introduced. You know, the two hosts. There's two hosts of the event, which they did a great job. Mostly everything was in Bahasa, which is the language, the Indonesian language.
Uh-huh.
There was some English involved, but very minimal. Me being the hosts were good. They went around. They called some people out, including myself.
Really?
I only saw one other Caucasian at the wedding. Out of 1,200 people, I don't believe they were American.
Wow.
I was the only American. I did get called up on stage, and I was being bantered by the hosts, and they were having good fun with me. But you know, hey, it's all in good fun, so I enjoyed it. Nothing I can say against it. It was a lot of fun. The hosts also had live dancers. They had I felt like there were live dancers going on. Then you have Dancing with the Stars. There were these two dancers that were dancing, basically Dancing with the Stars. And basically the whole show was going on a stage. They award of them. I mean, from boom operated cameras, their lights. You know, I mean, I'm telling you, I have pictures and video of all of this, so I'm not lying. I can show everyone. I have evidence.
So
it was just, it was really just outrageous. Everything was just really over the top. I was just, half the time I'm just sitting there wow. And then you're sitting at your table, they're bringing you up a 6 or 7 course dinner. And that was basically by the time it actually started around, I think right around 6:30 p.m., and it was over 9 p.m. it was over.
Okay.
It was done. Everyone was there. Also, no alcohol, unless you smuggled it in. No alcohol involved. And afterwards, there was a little after party. I actually did not attend.
Uh-huh.
But, it was something just over the top, Dan, I have to say. It was just like, wow. And I asked my girlfriend, I asked her, is this a normal Indonesian wedding, or is this... And basically, she said it was. The one thing I will say, and it seemed like it was more for a status, maybe a status symbol.
Right.
And also maybe more for the groom's father who does own a business there. It was more focused on the event than maybe the couple. The couple was definitely a focus on them, but it was also a status. It was kind of like, you know, you see these shows where they have these really rich... family members in the U.S., reality TV shows, we have the Sweet 16 or something. It was really something along those lines.
Would you have liked your Sweet 16 to be like that?
Dan, if I had money, of course I would. If my would be 10 times better, I would have parachuted in, jumped out of a private jet. You know me, Dan. These are the questions you don't... maybe the audience needs to hear this, but of course. If I had the money... my thing would be through the roof. I mean, of course. This thing had indoor fireworks going off and everything, Dan. I mean, I'm literally talking it was quite over the top. But I brought in the Sweet 16, the reality TV show reference, but this is actually a normal Indonesian wedding. It was not for, although maybe there was some kind of a status symbol being represented by the groom's father. It was very minimal. It's actually his tradition of an Indonesian wedding.
Now, is there any? Do you have any idea what the price tag was?
Oh, I thought about this, Dan. But I have to say, so I go by. All right, maybe in USD. I'm thinking because everything's very. It's for the most part pretty cheap here.
Right.
In the U.S. to hold something like this, we're talking minimum, very minimum, $50,000 USD.
For 1,200 people, Jim? For 1,200 people probably three times that.
That's only very minimum, but it's more like over $100,000 USD.
Easy.
I'm just really low-balling it here. At the very cheapest you could do this, I would say $50,000. But if you were to ask me to do this in the U.S., probably $125,000.
Yeah.
That's what I would think.
Yeah.
What they pay here, I mean, everything's a lot cheaper here in Indonesia, so I would say it was significantly reduced. Maybe, I don't think they would have spent more than $50,000 USD for it, but definitely over $25,000. Maybe $50,000 to $75,000 USD.
Yeah, that's...
So that's well over, let me tell you, when I go to Indonesia, Dan, I'm a millionaire.
Yeah.
So, with the translation of money. So it's much different in the conversion. It's definitely well over $100,000 SGD as well.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So about, it could... probably, I'm really low balling all this. It could be much more.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking at least been around 50,000 USD.
Okay, perfect. Jim, look, we've had a lot of speaking from the since the top of the hour. We're going to take a quick music break. This has been Now Boarding with Jim and Dan. This is the Travel Show and WGXC 90.7 FM. Jim, we're going to elaborate further. Actually, you know what?
Dan,
I'm going
to
do something.
I mean, this is the first time in over 6 months I stepped foot on an airplane. Can you believe that?
Oh, okay. You know what? Go ahead. Continue. Let's, the music can wait. It's, we'll do this. We'll do the music on the, I don't even know if anyone likes our music Jim.
Dan, let me ask a question. Let's be honest here.
Go ahead.
Why do we even play music when people can listen to the sounds of our voices? You know, let's just be realistic and honest here, you know. Come on. You know, we don't need music. Music is to give us some time to breathe.
Yeah, I know it. You know, people can go on their iPods or their computers or into their vehicles or into their little spaces and listen to their own music of their choice. So, you know what? We're going to take control right now. We're going to continue with this dialogue. It's we're going to march on, Jim. It's
let's do it. I'm going to quickly cover the airfare thing, the air trip, and then we're going to get right into what will be the next show, an epic show coming up. But we'll get into that. Give me 2 minutes. So Dan.
Yes.
Last week I flew for the first time in over 6 months.
How did that feel?
And
previously you had been going every month on a plane, just for pure pleasure.
It is true that there was a time where I spent a significant amount of time on an airplane. I think it was 100 hours actually in the air in a one-month period.
Uh-huh.
But we won't get into that. This time, you know, a lot of traveling. You know, I have made a lot of airline miles. I have airline mile accreditations from what I've done. And then, boom, just no travel. No airplane flights for over 6 months. And last week was the first week. I used to love flying. A brief background. I used to love flying as a kid. First I ever flew was to Disney when I was 14, I believe. And every time I loved flying. About my 35th flight, I was flying home from Aruba to Miami.
Uh-huh.
And the plane had to emergency land in San Juan, Puerto Rico. That basically changed my whole entire view of flying, and I have hated flying ever since.
Okay.
I did survive that incident, and actually the incident was pretty much fine. The stewardesses were very nervous. The hydraulic systems on the plane failed. They foamed the runway, the emergency vehicles followed us in, and just the look on the steward's face made me almost poop my pants, and it was very, very nerve-wracking experience, and ever since then, I have hated flying. Since then, I did fly the 100 hours in 1 month, and, you know, I'm getting back into it, but the six-month drought of flying, really, like, all last week prior to my flight, I was getting so nervous, and, you know, I did have to take a couple alcoholic beverages before getting on the flight, but, you know, the flights went safe. I'm here today, and, you know, I'm ready to get back in the air soon, and I'm ready to get back in.
Okay. Hey, that sounds great. Jim, now, I'm sure you're going to be back, you're going to be back in the air in what, a few weeks? Is that what the estimate is? For much longer?
Dan, I am hoping if things go well, this is the fifth Sunday that we do cover the air, is that correct?
Fifth Sunday. I believe there are five Sundays in December, yes.
There is.
Yeah.
There is, and this is the one that we cover the 29th of December, is that correct?
Yeah, we can. That shouldn't be an issue.
Well, Dan, if things go well, I will be live in studio.
What?
On December 29th.
What? Really?
Yes, Dan, yes. I will. I have not booked the flight yet, but after careful thought and deliberation, I have decided, now I am not making my official return, but I am going to come back and visit for a week and a half, and I will be here Sunday, the 29th of December, live in studio, Dan. I will promise not only you, Dan, but I will promise all of our viewers, that show will be nothing less than epic. That show, we will have multiple guests, and that show, I mean, Dan, we may have to make that a two-hour show. We may have to talk to Effie, and he may have to be incorporated in. This show is going to be big, Dan. The 29th of December, everybody mark your calendars. plan on taking a road trip that day to get in your cars to listen to us. December 29th, me, Jimmy, back in studio with Dan, and we are going to do it up. I promise that. This will be the best show. I'm gonna make a statement. That will be the best show we've ever had.
Oh, my goodness. Jeez.
Dan, I'm not done.
Revelation.
Dan, I am not done yet.
What is it? Go ahead. Everyone's... I think there are some car crashes outside the park right now. Oh, my goodness.
I imagine so. There's people with signs waving. I imagine.
Oh.
But, Dan, I'm not stopping there because before our best show ever, that will be our show in 2 weeks, which will also be the best show ever up until this point. And do you know why that is, Dan?
Because we're going to have a special, special guest who will be arriving in your hemisphere, who has already arrived in your hemisphere, I believe, by the name of Yassine Al-Medina.
Al-Medina himself, that he is officially safely landed in Malaysia. He is a 40-minute flight away from us. He is in the same time zone as me right now.
Oh,
he will be here in Singapore, live in my makeshift studio.
Alhamdulillah. Oh my goodness, Jim! I'm gonna try this music break one more time. I'm gonna play a song that has to be played. Bottom line, it's got to be played. It's coming up. There's going to be. I think you might be able to predict what this song is. It's a couple years old, but hey, it exemplifies everything that you're saying in terms of Al-Medina this holiday. Well, not the holiday season. But your return, Jim. Here we go. Okay.
Let the rain wash away all the pain of yesterday. I know my kingdom awaits, and they've forgiven my mistakes. I'm coming home. I'm coming home. Tell the world I.
Where I belong, yeah. I never felt so strong, and
I'm back.
I'm feeling like there's nothing I can't try. And if you with me, put your hands high.
Put your hands high. If you haven't lost a life before, this one's for you.
Me, put your hands high.
Your dreams are filled. You're rocking with the best. I'll be on the song.
I hear the tears of a clown. I hate that song. I always feel like they're talking to me when it comes on. Another day, another dawn. Another Keisha, nice to meet you. Get the math, I'm gone. What am I supposed to do when the club lights come on? It's easy to be Puff, but it's harder to be Sean. What if my twins ask me why I ain't married a mom? Damn, how do I respond? What if my son stares with a face like my own and says he wants to be like me when he's grown? Shit, but I ain't finished grown.
Okay, we are back. This is WGXC 90.7 FM. You're listening to Now Boarding with Jim and Dan. Jimmy, revelation pouring out from your lips that you will be returning. I had to play Diddy Dirty Money coming home from your one of the most influential people that you've never met onto your life, which comes in the form of, What's his name, Jimmy? Jiminovich? You've actually, you did make eye contact with him back a couple years ago. But anyway, that would be Diddy Dirty Money, P. Diddy.
My boy Diddy, yes. Dan, and yes, I will be coming home if things go well in 3 weeks. And I will be live in studio on the air December 29th to raise all kinds of hell and to have a great, epic show.
Yes, Jim, this is very good news. Very good news. You know, it wouldn't be the same without you to have an entire year without you being, you know, at least footing set back in our center of Hudson and being live in the studio. It's going to be a lot that has to be discussed. It'll probably be difficult for you to march through the streets to get to the studio with all of the people celebrating your return. But, you know, I think that we're going to make it happen. We're going to make it happen, Jim.
I'm expecting a parade of Flag Day-like proportions, Dan, when I return. And if nothing less, we'll be disappointed.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, yeah. Jimmy, we got 5 more minutes. What further would you like to highlight for this show? We only had about 1 minute of music time before I had to edit ourselves. I had to censor ourselves. But what else would be upon your agenda? I was having an interesting conversation earlier this morning when someone brought up to me, being that I'm going to be going into my hibernation season, where I have extensive time that I am free, not with too much responsibility, where I can, in fact, go somewhere for a month's time, really anywhere in the world, and, you know, just take off. And we were discussing where would that place be if you had to rent an apartment for a month and have that as your satellite and go to other areas. Now, this person had said that she would pick Italy or somewhere in South America, being that she hasn't been to Italy. It would still be a decent time in this during the winter. But South America, probably somewhere around the cone area of Argentina or Chile or Uruguay, being that it would be summer there. Now, where would you decide, Jim? Where would you decide Jimmy Jiminovich if you had that availability, 1 month, and you had saved up?
Well, then,
responsible spending.
I guess in the end, I decided Singapore because I didn't have hibernation season or anything. I just decided it's time. And why Singapore? You know, it just ended up happening that way. But Dan, for you, I think you should also start your trek. I don't know, maybe start or have your trek bring you here to Singapore. And we will do our radio show live together night in Singapore, both of us.
All right.
But if you know, because I am hoping to come home, and to come home, I'm actually giving up a trip to come back to the U.S., and that trip will be my Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam trip. And, you know, I think Southeast Asia has a lot to offer, Dan, and I think you should look into it.
Okay.
I actually am sacrificing that trip, but I will go. It's already, I will do it on a later date, actually a month later in February for the Chinese New Year. You know, Southeast Asia has a lot to offer, Dan. Food-wise, I think you'd be very impressed. I've been impressed ever since I've been here. As for my future, I think I'll lead to either South America or Asia, you know, like what we would consider Asia, not anyone here but me and you know, Tokyo, China. I'd like to go to China, actually.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. That's, Jim, that's great. Now, we're going to sign off here, and I'm going to play one last song. But this is great news. Next episode, we will be featuring someone who we've been talking about. And in less than a month, less than 30 days, Jimmy, you will be here live in studio, you know, as well as everything goes well. Good Lord willing, and shall I, and we will see you then. For now, we're going to sign off. Everyone, thank you. Effie's coming up for another spectacular show in the cut. We're signing off with a little holiday U2. Jimmy, this goes out to you as well.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
It's Christmas. Baby, please come home.